The Athletic.
Totally Football Show. Today, golf v football. It's the Ryder Cup weekend, but there's plenty of clubs, eagles and big wedge ahead in Premier League Match Day 7. We preview Spurs-Liverpool and the rest of the weekend's runners and riders. Also today, there's WSL returns, unhappily in Napoli, what we had before we had stats, and why Kevin Keegan resigned. All that and more in this Totally Football Show. Thursday, the 28th of September, and hello to you, listener. On the show today, Duncan Alexander.
Hello, James.
Tom Williams.
Hello, James.
And Kiva O'Neill.
Hello.
Hello to you all. Obligatory mention for Duncan's knitwear. Tom, do you want to do the honours?
Yeah, Duncan is wearing a very fetching jumper.
Autumnal.
Very autumnal. The first jumper I've seen this autumn. And he told us that he'd been complimented multiple times on his way in today. And, you know, having seen it myself, I'm not surprised.
All right. If you're curious to know what all the fuss is about, listener, jump on our YouTube channel, The Totally Football Show. Rachel will be posting images of that and so much more. Oh, we've got James Horncastle on the line in a bit as well. Let's talk about the Carabao Cup, because it happened this midweek. Here's Matt Davis-Adams. I bloody love the League Cup, says Matt. No magic lost, gained, because it never existed. T-shirt weather in the early rounds, not for Duncan. Straight to pens, the Alan Hardacker trophy, Renato Sanchez passing to the Carabao hoarding. All fine points. Don't forget the traditional search engine crashing team sheets as well in early rounds like the one we just had this week. Did you bloody love the League Cup this midweek?
I just had to look up the Alan Hardacre trophy.
Did you?
Know what it is at the top of their head?
No, I do not.
League Cup trophy? Or no, the Man of the Match.
It's the Man of the Match trophy.
Is that right?
Yeah, the trophy is named after Alan Hardacre, the EFL's former secretary, who conceived the League Cup, which makes it look like someone impregnated him with the League Cup.
How did he think of this crazy cup competition involving multiple teams?
I've always felt that you can have a league and you can have a cup, but you can't have two League Cups. I've got to... Fundamental ethical. It would be a bit like having two leagues and saying, okay, yeah, that you can win this league, and then there's the Carabao League, which is a bit shorter.
Yeah.
And it's over in March. That would be mad.
When I was a kid, our football manager invented supplementary cups at the end of the year so that we could actually win a trophy. So nice. It seems a little bit churlish. But Tom will remember, like, in France.
So is it for Man United to get something?
Yeah, essentially, yeah. But it sounded better in French when they had one. It was the Coupe de la Ligue.
Yeah, but what have they decided, yeah, Tom?
They've junked it.
Yeah, not only junked can they build it. Railways, they can also get rid of surplus cup competitions.
Yeah, junked the Coupe de la Ligue, trimmed the size of Ligue 1 to 18 clubs. It's all about quality over quantity for France.
Right.
Except sometimes there are quite serious issues.
We'll do the
with
quantity
the
first, and then we'll... Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll work on those. But how about, I mean, we had 16 games midweek, only one draw in there, which went straight to penalties because it's the Carabao Cup. Among the other headlines, Liverpool beat Leicester, Chelsea beat Brighton 1-0. Everton won their second match in a row. This one was 2-1 away at Villa, while Luton got knocked out by League One Exeter. They exited, one might say. Wednesday night, though, perhaps the biggest result of all, which saw Newcastle beating Man City 1-0. This is the first time that a Pep Guardiola side has ever fallen at the first hurdle of a cup competition. This feels like a big deal.
I think it kind of is, in the sense that the possibility of an English club winning the quadruple has been this sort of, you know, mirage that's existed in English football ever since the conception of... That's the word I was looking for, James.
Mm.
Ever since the conception of the League Cup by Alan Hardacre back in the day. And very few teams are capable of doing it. Manchester City obviously are. They've already won a domestic treble in recent history. They won the treble last season. So, you know, going out in the League Cup is not a big deal. I can't imagine that any of their fans would be too upset about it. But I think for like players who played in ultra-successful teams, the things that motivate them when they get to a stage of just, you know, dominance is like setting targets. Well, next season we're going to go one better. We're going to win this. We're going to beat this points tally, etc. So, yeah, not a big deal, but a minor disappointment nonetheless.
Pep made 8 changes from the team that had won at the weekend against Forest. Newcastle, though, under Eddie Howe, left only Nick Pope in goal and changed everybody else.
Should you be allowed to make 10 changes and beat Man City? Like, it doesn't feel right, does it?
Intriguingly, it was only when... Because Man City were all over them in the first half. I think it's fair to say But then at halftime, he brought on Bruno Guimaraes and hard-working's Anthony Gordon, and that turned things around. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think so. Well, it gave Newcastle more of a cutting edge, and I think City, despite the fact they were dominating possession, weren't really creating much at all. I think Alvarez had a couple of early chances. Nick Pope made one half-decent save with his feet, but I think, you know, without the big guns, they were sort of struggling to really get in behind. And, you know, Eddie Howe clearly realised that they were potentially there for the taking and made the changes. And then, yeah, Newcastle scored quite a nicely constructed goal with Joe Linton sort of jagging across the box from left to right and hooking it across, and Isak tucks it in. And, yeah, then I think managed to keep City at arm's length with relative ease thereafter. And you think about how relatively gloomy the atmosphere was around Newcastle a few weeks ago, and they were on that run of three consecutive defeats, and, oh, we've got the Champions League around the corner, you know, what sort of state is the club in going into that? And actually, okay, they were absolutely battered by Milan, but came away with a very decent 0-0 draw, massacred Sheffield United at the weekend, knocked City out of the League Cup, and have got PSG next week in the Champions League. And, you know, the sort of mood is a bit sunnier all of a sudden.
Man City, meanwhile, who kept Erling Haaland. Was he on the bench? Yeah, he kept him on the bench for the whole game. No Rodri, of course. Was that stroke's chin significant?
I'm intrigued as to how Guardiola will replace Rodri, because the obvious thing to do would be to put Calvin Phillips in, because he plays in the same position and he is, you know, a very good footballer. But something tells me he's going to do anything he can to avoid doing that. Yeah, Kovacic. I mean, yeah, it'll be Kovacic and someone else, I would have thought. Kovacic and Nunez, maybe.
Nunez back at his old club, maybe.
Yeah,
right?
You know, but lacks a bit of, you know, sort of...
But Pep did kind of list some players he was impressed with after the game, and Phillips was not in that list.
Who did he mention?
Pretty much everyone else.
So. Somebody who has got that that you were talking about, Tom, is Bruno Guimaraes. I know you loved his nutmeg at Bramall Lane on Sunday.
Yeah, I mean, just I think as a style of nutmeg, it is possibly my favourite nutmeg. And for anyone who hasn't seen it, it was in the first half when Newcastle weren't yet running away with the game, and he has the ball in the centre circle, and the guy he nutmegs is sort of standing behind him, like diagonally to his right, and he kind of nutmegs him using like the outside of his right foot, like the studs on the right hand side of his boot. And the guy, I'm not sure he was even attempting a tackle. He was an innocent bystander. It was like a drive-by nutmeg. And I'm not sure whether this style of nutmeg has a name. I suspect it probably
needs
does.
A name.
But if anyone knows, let us know. Hit us up.
Which way was he facing? Because I watched it. So was he going, because he goes forward and then back. But
yeah, and this is like, in addition to the fact the guy he nutmegs is an innocent bystander, he's standing between Guimaraes and his own goal. So not only does he not have to nutmeg the guy, but in doing so, it takes him further away from the opposition goal.
So there were some people who felt, or there are some people that feel that running up an 8-0 scoreline against your opponents is just unnecessary humiliation. But what you're saying is that already they had the wrong attitude from the word go in Newcastle.
Utter disrespect from the get-go.
Right.
Yeah, clearly. Okay. Awful, awful scenes.
Where do you stand, Kiva, on running up scorelines? This has been a topic of debate after the 8-0 last weekend.
I mean, when your team are scoring loads of goals, surely you just want that to continue.
Yeah.
Like, but at the same time, when you're watching it, I think as a neutral, I always just feel sorry for the other team.
Do you? Do you not feel like, come on, let's have 10? That's the first thing, because as soon as somebody goes 1-0 up, I'm like, finally, we're going to get double figures.
1-0 looks a bit like 10.
It does, doesn't it? No, it's a fair point, Kevin. Tom, you were mentioning Kevin Keegan.
Yeah, well, seeing as we're talking about a Newcastle thrashing, it put me in mind of another Newcastle thrashing from back in the day that elicited unexpected feelings of sympathy. When Newcastle beat Tottenham 7-1 in the 96-97 season, it convinced Kevin Keegan, manager of Newcastle, that it was time to resign, because during the game, he happened to look across the touchline at the crestfallen Jerry Francis, his opposite number, and he felt so bad that he realised his heart was no longer in it. He said, I just wanted to go over there and give him a cuddle.
Right.
And that's when I knew it was time to get out. So that's how much Kevin Keegan felt guilty about running up a scoreline. He resigned over the matter.
Good Lord.
And was never as successful a manager ever again. So that's the standard by which we'll hold all other managers
responsible. So last time you were on, you had that wonderful story about Chelsea supporters singing Ue Cantona. And some people question the veracity of that, but you're confident that this is actually true. Kevin Keegan resigned because his team... beat Spurs 7-1.
Well, he explained in a subsequent interview, which I have gone to trouble of looking up, it was the expression on the face of Jerry Francis, a man I like and respect a great deal. I looked at him and thought, oh no, how must he be feeling inside? blah, 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 blah.
Am I Kevin Keegan?
I wanted to go up and give him a cuddle. And I knew that was it. When you feel like that, you have to get out.
Well, you do,
you could
you?
Have just given him a cuddle, and then it might have dissipated the...
No, but I think Duncan, the deeper point is, when you're in a position of wanting to give your opponent a cuddle, you've lost that edge.
Really?
And Alexander looked before him and saw there were no more Jerry Francis to
perhaps he saw that Jerry Francis's mullet and decided to think of his career and mullet over.
Is that what you're...
Yeah, that's
all right, we'll move on. All right, then. Thank you so much for that, Tom. Newcastle will be hosting Burnley this weekend. They will be travelling to Old Trafford in round four of the League Cup in October for a rematch, of course, of last year's final.
12th successive home draw for Manchester United in domestic cup competitions, which statistically, I'm no expert on this, it strikes me as unlikely.
That is extraordinary.
But it is a 50-50 chance each time. So,
but what are the odds?
In a row.
What are the odds of that, though?
I know I want to spend the rest of my time discussing this. But yeah, I feel compelled to mention that the next round also features West Ham Arsenal. They had away wins over Brentford and Lincoln City, respectively. Everton will be taking on Burnley. The Sean Dyche Classico, anybody? Bournemouth will be up against Liverpool. Didn't Liverpool get a big result themselves against Bournemouth last season?
9-0. And I actually had two tickets for that game and gave me two sisters the ticket. And I went to watch Blackpool instead. And then, to make it worse, then I'd like told... our editor, Laura, I was like, I'm in Blackpool and I had a ticket today. And then we did this whole piece on like the game that you've missed, basically. So it was kind of like laughing at me, basically, missing a game where Liverpool scored nine goals.
Hey, still something to hold over your sisters for as long as you need to. It's useful to have that kind of thing in your back pocket sometimes.
Yeah, well, they haven't been to many matches and I kind of thought, well, you know, at least they've seen a lot in one.
Yeah, that's your lot now.
You know, that's all now, girls.
Chelsea fans dream of seeing nine goals in a season, let alone one game. Also, in the next round of action, you've got Exeter, who will be at Borough, I think, or maybe hosting Borough. League Two's Mansfield Town, the lowest-ranked team still in the competition, will be up against Port Vale. Anyway, that's the Carabao Cup. We've got Premier League Match Day 7 on the way, but next up, we're going to dally a bit further. Funny, what on earth's been going on down in Naples this week?
Hi everyone, David Ornstein here, and I want to tell you about The Athletic's new bite-sized podcast, The Daily Football Briefing. If you're one of those people who are just too busy for a regular length podcast in the morning, this is right up your street. In just over 10 minutes, we'll bring you bang up to date with the biggest stories in football, all before you've finished your first coffee of the day. It'll be Matt Slater on a club's ongoing takeover saga, our club experts reflecting on big overnight matches, and let's be honest, me explaining those transfer stories that just won't go away. That's The Daily Football Briefing, every weekday morning, available wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. The Athletic is the only place you can read articles by Daniel Taylor, Amy Lawrence, Phil Hay, James Pearce, Ollie Kay, and the very best football writers around.
Listener, what's going on in Naples? Last summer, Napoli won the Italian title and the hearts of football fans all over Europe. Fast forward a few months and manager Luciano Spalletti has left and his replacement, Rudy Garcia, has got the club off to a very rocky start to the season. Last week, their socials thought they'd lighten the mood by making a TikTok video depicting star striker Victor Osimhen, the man who played through fractured cheekbones and led them to the title, their most important and beloved player, as a coconut. Then, after the weekend's 0-0 with Bologna, when Osimhen missed a penalty, socials put out this.
Give me a penalty, please. Oh, referee, thank you. You give me a penalty.
Osimhen has reacted by deleting all of his pictures in a Napoli shirt from his channels. His agent, meanwhile, raised the idea of suing the club for damages. James Horncastle now joins us on the line. James, have you ever seen a club do something like this to their own player on social media?
No, I have seen a Italian club put out a tweet using one of their players in a photo, making a gesture that I would say is offensive to Chinese people. That was Juventus not so long ago. And this is just bizarre. I mean, even the video that came out at the weekend, the I'm a Coconut video, which has racial overtones, I mean, that was bad enough. But I've never seen a club put out a video that mocks the player, the star player, the current Serie A capocannoniere, the top scorer, in the way that the one about his penalty miss did. Bizarre behaviour.
I mean, is there a chance that it was a deliberate ploy by the club or just an astonishing error by an intern or something?
I would struggle to believe that it's a deliberate strategy by the club. I mean, they would like to keep the player. They kept him even though there was interest from Saudi Arabia in the summer, which I think even if the bid had come in from Al Hilal, it would have made Osimhen the most expensive player ever to leave the league. It would be a record transfer, beating the one set by Pogba for Juventus to Man United and Lukaku for Inter to Chelsea. Yeah, they've been in negotiations about a new contract all summer, and it did at one point look like that was going to be close. They now look further apart than they've ever been. I think it probably does come down to a human error by an intern or a social media operative for the club. You know, and often these people are kind of underpaid. They're not talked about within the company until they do something like this. They're always trying to be original, trying to sort of jump on trends that they see on TikTok, trends that are on X, trends that are on Instagram. And this was a terrible mistake, really. So, you know, I don't think the club wanted to be in this position. You've seen the reaction. You know, they have been called racist. People are clamouring for Osimhen to leave the club. I still think that's difficult to foresee, even though there have already been reports. I saw Gazzetta dello Sport reporting that a move in January is on the cards. But frankly, I think one of the reasons Osimhen stayed in the summer, aside from De Laurentiis' valuation of the player, is there's an African Cup of Nations in January. And so you will not have the player. Napoli will not have the player or any new club. So it's in Napoli's interest to get the player to commit to a new contract. And I think that's going to be tough, James.
Yeah. Well, imagine being the intern whose clever TikTok cost Napoli their best player. I'm sure people in Naples would take that well.
Yeah. Although some of the response in Naples has been, it's just banter, ironia, you know, and that the club and La Maglia, the jersey, should come first, should come before everything. I mean, even some of the big fan organizations, the ultra groups, before Wednesday's game against Udinese, they kind of implored the fans to come to the stadium in Napoli colors to show that it's the club that matters more than any one individual. And, you know, that was as much a response to what happened the night before with the statement put out by Osimhen's agent, Roberto Calenda, but also, you know, Osimhen's reaction to being substituted in the 0-0 against Bologna on Sunday. So, you know, it's Naples is a complicated city. It's a quite moody city. You know, even last year when they were running away with the league and about to win the Scudetto for the first time in 33 years, you know, there were protests at the stadium, you know, about the running at the club thing. They weren't happy with everything, even though all their dreams were about to come true. So, you know, it is complicated. Although, if that's one element of the fan base, there was another element on Wednesday, which was there were Nigeria flags in the stands. Osimhen was applauded during the warm up. He applauded back. So yeah. It's an interesting situation, James. I mean, even in all of your experience covering Serie A, I'm not sure you could find an equivalent.
No, I've never seen a club put out something like that, essentially mocking their own player after he misses a key penalty. But it's the kind of thing that a rival club might do, rival fans might do, but your own club. Osimhen, as you mentioned, although things looked pretty frosty when he arrived at training post this latest storm, played and indeed scored for Napoli in a 4-1 win Wednesday night. He then ran over to the sideline and celebrated with the man next to manager Rudy Garcia, which was interesting. But just one last thing for now, though, James. Has the club actually said anything about all this, that they regret what's happened or any kind of position from the club officially?
No, they are not commenting, or weren't when we went to comment for them. Aurelio De Laurentiis, the owner, he put out a tweet after the Bologna draw in which he said, kind of like, our season starts now in Bologna. And he did tweet after the 4-1 win over Udinese, and it was, our season really did start in Bologna. So he completely did not reference to, he made no reference to what has happened over the last few days, which, it's not only a story about TikTok, it's a story about Osimhen's transfer to Napoli in the first place from Lille and continued investigations into that, because earlier in the day, the same day that Osimhen's agent threatened legal action against Napoli for these videos, it emerged that De Laurentiis has been placed under investigation by magistrates in Rome looking into Osimhen's transfer. Yeah, Napoli deny any wrongdoing, had been cleared by the Italian Football Federation, had been cleared in part by magistrates in Naples looking into the same thing. But it's quite remarkable, you had this kind of maelstrom of Osimhenia going on over the last few days. So, yeah, the club didn't put up any executives to talk before the game against Udinese, which sometimes happens. A sporting director sometimes comes out and says it was all basically on Rudy Garcia, the manager. And all Garcia said was that it was a couple of clumsy posts, that no one on TikTok wanted to do any harm, just as Victor and his agent didn't want to do any harm with the statement that they put out on social media as well. And that Garcia, when he started coaching 30 years ago, his job was 80% on the training ground and 20% sort of dealing with everything that happened around it, players, agents, executives. And he said, now it's the other way around. Now he gets 20% of the job is tactics and working on the training ground, and 80% is all the rest. So there you have it.
Mm. Well, James, another stormy week down in Naples. Look forward to speaking to you again in next Tuesday's Euros show. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Pleasure.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
Oof. Hey, Tom, speaking of stormy situations in Mediterranean port cities and managers.
And speaking of Napoli as well, former manager Gennaro Gattuso has just been appointed the new head coach of Marseille. Wow. What could possibly go wrong there? Dropping one of the most volatile coaches in European football into the roaring volcano that is Olympique de Marseille. But it has to be said that in recent seasons, Marseille have hired quite a lot of slightly mad coaches. Marcelo Bielsa, El Loco himself, Jorge Sampaoli, Igor Tudor, and they've all generally done quite well
maybe.
And been sort of embraced by the fan base. So maybe there is a method to the quite literal madness.
Okay. No, because the issue with the previous incumbent, Marcelino, was that the...
Quite too boring. Very boring.
Right.
Not mad enough.
Okay.
So they tried the whole nice, sensible, 4-4-2 man, didn't like it.
Also, because if the fans turn up at the meeting looking for a scrap, because he's not a bad person to have on your side. Hopefully all that kind of thing will be avoided in future. Marseille reeling from resignations and a hammering at the weekend by PSG.
And we've got Brighton, of course, next weekend in the,
of course.
In the Europa after a 3-3 draw at Ajax.
Yeah, another stormy port city.
Oh, yeah.
Excellent. All right, Premier League. Last Sunday's show was a bit skimpy on coverage of some of the Sunday games because they weren't on TV and all of our guests had gone to the North London Derby. No chance of any of those issues this weekend because there's no North London Derby, and pretty much all the football's on Saturday. There's 8 games on the Saturday, only one on the Sunday. I bet it's a big one as well. And then there's one on Monday evening. So the early game Saturday sees Aston Villa taking on Brighton. At 3 o'clock, you've got Man United up against Crystal Palace, who, of course, they've just beaten in the League Cup 3-0. Newcastle, fresh from the Man City win, will be hosting Burnley. Man City are at Wolves. Bournemouth are up against Arsenal. West Ham take on Sheffield United. And Everton face Luton in the other 3 o'clock games. That's followed Saturday evening by fourth against second, Spurs against Liverpool. Woof. Sunday, what's the big game that's got the whole day to itself? Nottingham Forest, Brentford. Feast on it. Drink it in. And then Monday evening, it's an all West London affair. Fulham, Chelsea. A fun fact, Leicester have scored more Premier League goals this year than Chelsea, and they were relegated in May. All right. Why Forest Brentford on Sunday?
It's a curious weekend. Apparently, the schedules have been cleared because of some golf tournament, which seems a bit strange to me. Don't know.
The Ryder Cup. The big finale is coming on Sunday afternoon.
Yeah.
Here's Sky's Sunday choices, the last three occasions Ryder Cups were held in Europe. Well, this one was Nottingham Forest against Brentford, or is. Previous one was Cardiff Burnley. The one before that, West Brom Burnley. Yeah.
Classics.
Absolutely. All right, Kiva. Well, Saturday evening, anyway, we do have a classic. And if it's Europeans and Americans wielding clubs against each other, you can't say fairer than Spurs against Liverpool. Liverpool, who are arriving from their fourth successive 3-1 win. This one in the League Cup against Leicester, with some really tasty goals in it as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Dominic Szoboszlai's goal was ridiculous.
That's a lovely ball by Endo. That's Dominic Szoboszlai! Oh, that's electrifying! You just cannot even put into words the start he's had.
I mean, Liverpool fans are already completely just obsessed with him. He's played 8 games now. Obviously, wears the number 8. He's, I think, selling more shirts than anyone. There's really? Just this almost mystique and cult around him, but it's because of what he does on the pitch. He does feel like the closest you've watched in terms of a midfielder to Steven Gerrard, which is
he's gone there.
So early to say, but everyone's been saying it. So I feel like it's okay to sort of, you know, see it and say it now, because it is just, I mean, I think he hit the ball faster than Gerrard ever could against Leicester. It was ridiculous, the speed and the technique.
His shooting's so good. Like, we detailed it in The Athletic, but his dad made him wear small boots to sort of keep his feet ready for thunderbolts.
From what age, Duncan?
Sort of.
From birth.
Yeah.
From birth, yeah.
Did when he bind you get his feet?
Yeah. Straight out of the womb. Get these on you, Dominic.
Get these predators on. No. But from when he was a kid playing football.
Right. Wear small boots because you'll have better control.
Yeah, the old Beppe Signori special.
Beppe Signori used to wear 5.5, and he was small, but he wasn't that small.
There's great variety in that Liverpool attack. And I think when all those players came in, you could see what the club were trying to do in terms of lots of different profiles, dribblers, penalty box players. Darwin Nunez, who's just this sort of, you know, raging thunderstorm of a footballer. And when it all kind of slots together, it makes him really dangerous. And I think we are sort of belatedly seeing this reboot that it's felt Liverpool have needed to launch for the last few years. It is kind of starting to take shape, you know, with, as well, this completely new-look midfield.
Right. Leicester are taking the lead in this game through Casey McAteer. Is that any relation?
I did see that on following it on Twitter, and it was like 1-0 McAteer. It felt like a throwback, yeah. And obviously it was a Leicester player. But I watched actually a few of his goals. I think he posted a few on his Instagram, and it came up last night, and I was looking, and he looks like a really good player.
Cody Gakpo, a nice goal as well, spinning and shooting to equalise before Szoboszlai and then Diogo Jota. So another 3-1 win. The one at the weekend against West Ham, we barely mentioned on Sunday for reasons. How was that?
Yeah, again, there's like no sort of stress around Liverpool at the minute. Like, they can concede early, which they have in games, but they kind of come through. They're back into that like rhythm of not worrying too much about what happened. So Jared Bowen scores to make it 1-1 going into half-time. But it's just kind of this relaxed energy of like, we'll get the job done. And I don't think we've seen that from Liverpool for a while.
Were you expecting that this season?
No, I can't say. I predicted that they'd finish fifth, so what do I know? But yeah, it's been a slow sort of burn, I think, and it just come together. No one expected Szoboszlai to be as good as he is.
Yeah, and McAllister's been good, and you know, even getting Gravenberch into the squad as well. You know, he looked good in the Europa League. I think we've seen so many times teams buy a lot of players and it not quite gel that quickly, and it's actually quite unusual for it to gel this quickly. But I think Liverpool were kind of set up with the forward line, as Tom was saying. They just needed that supply, and it's kind of it's
even like
really well.
Wataru Endo, he had an excellent second half last night. Obviously plays the pass in pretty quick to Szoboszlai to get an assist, and it just feels Like, he's another player that's there. You know, it just feels like Liverpool have the strength and depth that you didn't really feel like they had coming into the season.
Also, Mo Salah, is he revitalised, or was it just that people had forgotten how good he is? What has he done? He's got 8 assists in his last 5 away games, scored and assisted in each of the last 12 Premier League matches.
Yeah, I think it's like, is it 15 goal involvement in 12 Premier League games? He's almost like, it was weird, like in the Europa League last week, watching him come on against LASK. It was like, okay, it's like the dad's come to like pick the kids up, you know. It felt like the grown-up had arrived almost, even though, you know, there were plenty of experienced and quality players on the pitch. But that's where he is right now. It's like, you know, you've got Liverpool and then you've almost got Mo Salah as like, you know, just in this sort of run.
Yeah, but there's this thing I'd almost call like production fatigue, which essentially is like when a player's been that good for that long. I remember this with Thierry Henry as well, when he was just kept posting 20 goal, 10 assist seasons. After a while, everyone just kind of shrugs and goes, yeah, that's what they do. Whereas if a new player was doing that, I'd be like, whoa, who's this new, you know, this new sensation. But Salah's, okay, last season, a little dip, maybe midway through the season, but generally his levels have never really fallen away, and I think people just take it for granted.
Yeah, his assist game now as well, he's becoming more of a provider, which I think he maybe, you know, he was more of the goal scorer for a long time, but now it just seems, I think he's currently got more assists than goals this season, which kind of speaks to how he's become almost like a creator as well, and some of his passes have been brilliant. And
he's getting more space as well, because Liverpool sort of shuffled left a little bit, so he's kind of, for the first time in maybe since his first season, he's kind of been ignored a little bit by the opposition, because they have to worry about so many other things. So.
And one of the problems for Salah is that first season. He set the bar so high, inevitably, in terms of goal scoring at least, the numbers were going to come down, and his numbers every season since then have been exceptional, but because they were preposterous in season one, you kind of lose sight of just how ridiculously consistent he's been.
That's what makes the game this weekend so enticing.
Well, I was going to ask Kiefer, actually, because you weren't sure about Liverpool before. Now you're predicting they're going to win the title, maybe a treble.
I didn't
say that. How much of a test is this visit to Spurs? Spurs, who, I'm looking at the numbers here, they've only won one of the last 23 meetings with Liverpool in all competitions, with the Champions League final, of course, thrown in there as well. So, yeah, how big a test is this?
Yeah, this feels like the... Every week you're like, oh, this is the big test. And then actually it's the next week that is. But just because of how Tottenham are playing and the fluidity of their play and what Ange Postecoglou's done in just revitalising a, you know, not only a team of players but a fan base in a similar way that Jurgen Klopp did, I think, when he first came to Liverpool. Feels almost as a bit of a comparison to make there. I think, yeah, definitely a big test. But obviously... I think Liverpool fans probably worry in a way that surely Spurs are due a win in this, given I think the last one was at Wembley in 2017. So it just feels like it's going to happen one day.
A lot of people watch it to see, I guess, if there's a genuine contender to Man City. It's too early, but you can't help but wonder.
And they've kind of suited not having all the, you know, Liverpool or title contenders coming into the season. I think, if I'm right in remembering, the first season, like under Jurgen Klopp, when they actually sort of became title contenders, it was a similar sort of story. And then almost in 2022 as well, when they almost won the league, it felt, again, another similar story where, you know, not really coming into the season with that pressure. And maybe does that help them? And I don't know, there's something about Liverpool and, like, you could watch Jurgen Klopp skip towards the cop and, you know, he does those punches. And in that skip, you just can see that there's... a manager like really sensing something is happening here.
Actually, he's excited about his move to the German national team. Probably can't wait. They're facing Spurs this weekend, who have scored at least 2 goals in all of their first 6 games under Ange Postecoglou. Remarkable stuff. One question that people had about Liverpool before this great run was whether they'd sorted out things at the back, whether they'd brought in enough cover at the back. Is that still the one question you'd have about them, and how much will that be examined by Son Heung-min and co?
Yeah, I think sort of got off to a bit of a rocky start with Van Dijk, obviously getting his red card and then Konate being injured, but it feels like that gave way to Jadon Sancho, an academy graduate now, very much so, you know, gave way to him becoming... fifth choice, I guess, and then working his way up the ladder. And obviously, you've got Joel Matip and Joe Gomez there as well. So it feels like that's been a real positive. And without, I guess, bringing in another centre-back, that's gave Kwanzaa, you know, the opportunity to play. And he looked great against Leicester. and, you know, as someone that I've watched at the academy in the past, and certain players you look at and you kind of think, yeah, they've sort of got that quality and ability to be able to make it, and he's showing that now. So I do feel like there's still probably gaps, and yeah, there's still that feeling that Alisson will be needed at some point.
Well, Liverpool, curiously, only one clean sheet in the league so far this season in the home win against Villa, but simultaneously the second best defensive record. So they are at the same time letting in too many goals and not keeping enough clean sheets, but also keeping teams at bay more successfully than any other team apart from Man City.
Doesn't that mean that everyone's really, really bad at defending this season?
I guess it sort of does, yeah.
Who's got the best?
At Man City, three conceded.
All right.
Liverpool have let 5 goals in, but across 5 different games.
They're 2 points behind Man City for now. Tom, Spurs?
Yeah, I mean, interesting one for Spurs in that, you know, they've sort of turned up in every game so far this season. You know, beat Man United in their second game. Impressive performance against Arsenal at the weekend. Obviously didn't come away with a victory, but it kind of felt like they'd won, you know, on points, they'd won morally. I think Spurs fans were much more satisfied than Arsenal fans were, and they looked a little bit shaky in the first half, Spurs, with that playing out from the back and Arsenal pressing them. There were a few really wobbly moments. You think about that one where Maddison has his pocket picked by Jesus, who then blasts the ball over the bar, and you can feel the nerves within the Spurs ranks, but they just carried on playing the same way. They stuck at it, which is just the kind of a sure sign of a team having faith in the way they're playing, having a very clear idea of what they're supposed to be doing. And I think that, as much as anything, will have given them, you know, real optimism about the ability to replicate that. And there, this Liverpool game is just another opportunity to see whether you can play Ange ball against one of the top teams and get a decent result.
Man City, meanwhile, are at Wolves earlier in the day. That's one of the games that you referenced, Duncan. City trying to bounce back from their defeat to Newcastle midweek. Wolves, who got beaten by Championship leaders, or joint leaders, Ipswich. Wolves were actually 2-0 up in this game, and then Ipswich battled back. Did you see Jack Taylor's goal? Woof.
Jack Taylor, 25 yards out. Oh, my goodness me! Jack Taylor! That's unbelievable!
Very nice. Yeah. And a rare combo of like a nice passing move and a long-range screamer. Sort of two crackers in one, sort of.
Mm.
They are very good, Ipswich.
There you go. Well, they're through to the next round of the Carabao Cup.
Who would you have? If you had to have one team from the East in the Prem out of Ipswich and Norwich, who would you pick?
I'd go Ipswich. We had a lot of Norwich.
We've had a lot of Norwich.
Too much Norwich. We're all Norwich down.
Yeah.
Also, I've been watching Ed Sheeran's documentary and I'm just kind of obsessed with how nice he is. Has anyone watched it yet?
Ed Sheeran?
Yeah. Oh, my God.
Is he from Ipswich?
He's a big Ipswich fan.
Is he? I know nothing about Ed Sheeran. I was trying to keep it that way, but...
honestly, watch it. Honestly. Such a lovely guy.
All right. We'll see if the Rodri-less City can survive a visit to Molineux. That's at it. 3.
Lost 4 of their 14 games, City, since the start of 2019-20 when Rodri's been missing.
Really? Which, lost 4 of 14?
Yeah, which is, I would say in City terms, that's notable.
Yeah, absolutely. More than a blip. Very good. Next up, WSL.
Hi, I'm Ian Irving, host of Talk of the Devils, the Athletics podcast dedicated to Manchester United. Twice a week, I'm joined by Andy Mitten, Carl Anker and Laurie Whitwell as we bring you the very best insight from inside Old Trafford. You'll get all you need to know on transfers, tactical analysis, dare I say takeovers, and much, much more as we follow United home and away. You're not getting this anywhere else. So search for Talk of the Devils and listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show with James Richardson, the Sports Podcast Awards Soccer Podcast of the Year.
WSL returns this weekend. Well, it's number one, Women's Football League. Big questions. I guess the first one is, can Chelsea make it 5 league titles in a row?
Probably.
Okay.
I mean, there's just an energy around them, an Emma Hayes, and an inevitability. You've seen how hard Man United pushed them last season. And still, they just emerge at the end. On the last day, they obviously won the league and it was sort of, you know, heading that way. Obviously, there'll be other teams hoping Arsenal not in the Champions League, you know, whether that'll sort of actually stand to benefit them, even though it was, you know, painful not to qualify. I think, yeah, it's going to be one of the best seasons ever, but I feel like I say that every season.
Yeah, there has been this feeling that has been building year on year. Chelsea certainly bring in some big signings ahead of the new campaign. US international Katerina Macario and US youngster, is it Mia Fischel?
Fischel, yeah.
Fischel? Official? Yeah, no, known as Big Fish. Big Fish.
Sure, they've done that.
Are they, are Chelsea kind of very much following the same sensible spending, team-building model of the men's team, or are they very much throwing it out?
Probably, like, the opposite in terms of, like, they don't do a lot, but they do the right work. I mean, they obviously, you know, signed plenty of players and have needed to replace, you know, players like Harder and Eriksen, who've obviously left, you know, big figures at the club. And I think you sort of think of Chelsea that, you know, Sam Kerr's going to score all the goals anyway, but obviously Fischl will come in now and be looking to do that as well. The great thing about Emma Hayes is almost that, like, long-term plan, and she just seems to, like, know who the best players are and sign them before anyone else sort of gets there. And I think she's been a step ahead for such a long time, and, you know, obviously that's proven in how many cups and titles they've won. But I think the big one for them is obviously the Champions League. Got close, but I think this season that'll be, you know, definitely another sort of thing that you just feel like you'd like to see them do under Emma Hayes, because of just how incredible she is and what a dominant team she's built.
Fischl looks like an interesting signing. 47 goals in 64 games for Tigres in Mexico. Perhaps she'll get her debut this weekend when 5:30 on Sunday, when, you know, the golf, Chelsea will be taking on Spurs. Also, this weekend on Sunday, Villa up against Man United. That's the early game at 12:30. You've got Arsenal-Liverpool at 2, and then West Ham City at 3. Woof. Man United pushed Chelsea hard last time. How are they looking?
Yeah, I think losing Alessia Russo, you know, it felt inevitable in a way. Obviously, she's joined Arsenal. I think keeping Mary Earps was key, because that is a title-winning goalkeeper if ever I saw one. And just someone that you know, can you build a squad around a goalkeeper? It feels like Mary Earps is the one that you build it around. I think keeping her was fundamental to, you know, whatever they go and do this season. And can they get to that next level? Obviously, they've still got to go through qualifying rounds to get through to the Champions League. I think having, you know, a European campaign will really suit them, and obviously, you know, be the first time for them. So it'd be a shame almost for them to not get the rewards of European football after how well they played last season.
They, as I mentioned, begin their campaign away to Aston Villa. How much of an issue is Aston Villa's Castore kit? Did you see the way that this has been performing, notably in the League Cup midweek?
So it's been described as wet look, hasn't it? So
yeah.
The pictures that you see, it basically just looks like it holds basically all of the sweat. And I think it was Jackie Oatley who sort of, you know, brought this issue that Aston Villa women players were, you know, I think they played in the training match in pre-season games and have maybe played in it, the actual Aston Villa kit, once, because it's clinging to them and is uncomfortable. And I think, you know, image is something that I think women can struggle with, and, you know, being self-conscious and that kind of thing. And obviously Aston Villa are going to be on the telly, I think, for 4 games early in the season. So, you know, it's something that it's not just, I think, they've raised it. I think obviously the men's team have, and other teams that have Castore as the kit manufacturer as well. But it just feels like another sort of, you know, moment, I guess, we had with the white shorts and periods, and then, you know, in terms of like football boots being manufactured for men, even like socks are made for men and that kind of thing, you know. So it just feels like almost depressing that we've got another issue that we're working through. But in a way, you know, if change comes from it, then is that not a good thing in the end? But yeah,
I think the men's team would probably appreciate some change on that front as well. It looked really uncomfortable. Villa against Man United is on BBC Two at 12:30, 5:30 on Sky. You can see Chelsea Spurs. Excellent. All right. That's the opening round of the WSL. Next up, let's continue with round 7 of the Premier League.
We're all driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. you can use Indeed for scheduling, screening and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. According to their own survey, 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites. Remember the last time you were hiring and how slow and overwhelming it was? Well, you don't need to go through all that again. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent. And because you listen to the Totally Football Show, Indeed is going to give you a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at indeed.com/totally. That's INDEED.com/totally. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed at indeed.com. This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
Premier League. The three promoted teams, Luton and Burnley and Sheffield United, currently in the bottom three on a point apiece. Luton and Burnley have the chance to improve that on Tuesday when they'll be playing their game in hand. But meantime, this weekend, the Blades are at West Ham. Burnley visit Newcastle and Luton travel to Everton. Everton were 3 points above the Hatters and on a two-game winning streak. Kiva, what's going on the other side of Stanley Park?
Yeah, there's a really good mood back. I think winning games, Dominic Calvert-Lewin scoring a couple of goals. Feels like he's always been the key in even relegation battles of late, that if Everton can keep Dominic Calvert-Lewin fit and get him back scoring goals, then all will be well, and it sort of feels that way now. I think obviously beating Villa in the cup, another sort of boost. Mm-hmm. And then heading into the weekend's game, Everton should be beating Luton, you'd imagine. And then what do they do then? That's just such a mood booster, I think, isn't it? You know, three back-to-back wins potentially after such a struggle of a time.
So getting DCL back and the team just clicking, beginning to realise their chances, and all of a sudden it's a very different picture. And you see more of that this weekend against Luton, who you've been watching a lot this season.
Yeah, I have. So I've watched 4 out of 5 Luton games, watched them get beat all 4 times, and then, right. Yeah, it wasn't there to watch them get a point. So maybe it's me. Maybe I'm the problem.
All right.
I'm not there this weekend, so sorry, Everton fans. Could be a draw.
Beyond your absence or presence, what are the other issues that stand out for you with Luton?
Do you know, it's really sad that the deadline day signing, who they got from Arsenal, Sambi Lokonga, who really impressed me against Fulham. Just the player they needed almost, you know. He's got an injury now, so I think he'll be out for a little while, which is devastating for them, I think, because he just, for me, felt like almost the missing link in that midfield, or someone that can have a really big impact this season. So I think they'll want to get him back as soon as they can. But that feels like after getting that point and very much enjoying the season, like all the fans that I speak to are just having the best time. So
yeah, I still feel like Luton of the three are the most likely to stay up. I think we've said before, but they're adapting to it week by week, and they will get a few beatings. But and this is a massive game at Everton because, you know, it sounds like a 1980s game, Everton-Luton, and it might look like one as well. They're two of the three most long ball teams in the Premier League this season, so it could be physical. But, you know, Everton haven't scored a home goal yet this season. So
Luton haven't scored first yet.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of waiting for it.
That first goal is arguably the most important first goal we've ever seen.
Really?
But it feels like a very big week for Luton. In that obviously, haven't yet got a win. Had a chance to get a win against Wolves last weekend, playing against 10 men and only came away with a draw. And then to have Everton and Burnley, you know, two relegation rivals, you kind of feel like if they don't get anything out of those games, that early optimism that Kiva was talking about, and that you feel every time you watch Luton play at home, and the sort of the directness of their football might just start to fizzle out a little bit.
Burnley are concerning, I think, because they've got the least open play XG of any team in the Premier League this season. And I think people assume that the football they play under Vincent Kompany, you know, new Burnley, that they may concede, but at least they would be quite creative. But they've really struggled so far.
They were decent against Man United, I thought, last weekend. I mean, decent on the ball, perhaps.
Yeah,
not
they have. That's the thing.
Creative.
They have a lot of the ball.
They're quite fun.
Yeah, they're setting a lot of Burnley records for possession and passes each week. But
high bars, those.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
All right. Well, they're going to be at Newcastle. While Sheffield United, the other team down there, are at West Ham. That Burnley-Newcastle game, Burnley were 4-0 winners at Salford in the Carabao Cup, just to mention that. Ooh, they haven't won a league game at St James's Park since 1976. West Ham against Sheffield United, which is Saturday at 3 o'clock. Blades, of course, coming off that 8-0 thrashing last weekend. West Ham, who've had back-to-back defeats in the Premier League, but against Man City and Liverpool, asterisk. And they did get past Lincoln away in the Carabao Cup midweek.
On Sheffield United, it looked like they were starting to make a bit of progress. Mm. They had that 2-2 draw against Everton. Cameron Archer made a really impressive debut, scored the first goal, and then basically scored the second, the one that bounced in off the back of Jordan Pickford's head. 1-0 up at Spurs going into stoppage time and then concede twice. And you kind of feel like they're getting close, and they lose 8-0 against Newcastle. And all the wind has sort of gone from their sails.
Here's a stat. Paolo Di Canio's favourite goalkeeper, Wes Fodringham, has conceded, who's now, of course, minding the sticks, or whatever the expression is.
Getting the ball out the net.
What was the Di Canio-Fodringham thing again?
Well, so he substituted him early when he was in charge of Swindon. Yes. But then, as Benji was pointing out, and I'd forgotten this, I think kicked him up the bum as well, on the sidelines.
And Di Canio, who was once renowned for being kind to goalkeepers, or at least to one goalkeeper.
Wow, that's
one goalkeeper.
A massively overblown situation.
Well, you knew what you, I mean,
I'd
yeah,
love to see Di Canio take charge of Marseille, by the way. That would be a
I mean, it's
really
the logical progression before they start moving on to, you know, like actual
Except
maniacs.
The main thing he did when he went to Sunderland was ban ketchup, and they don't eat ketchup in Marseille.
Where's Fodring, though, that stat that I was coming to. So he's conceded the most goals, faced the most shots on target, and also made the most saves in the Premier League this season. In fact, no goalkeeper has ever made this many saves at the start of a Premier League campaign.
He's been busy.
The stats on this only began,
yeah,
Duncan, in 2003-04. Yeah. What were they doing before that?
Do you want the answer?
Yeah.
Basically, my old friends at Opta have got different... There's different points where data can be run. So that Fodringham thing, it's the joint most goals let in by keeper since the start of the Premier League after six games.
Okay,
got goals, that for the whole...
Yeah.
But in terms of...
That they bothered to
isolating
take
numbers for specific games...
Well, like even saves made?
Yeah.
They didn't... No one was...
Because no one was analysing the Premier League to this detail until 1997. And then from 97 till 03, it was done in a very, you know, turn of the millennium way. And it's
like
not
what? What were they taking note of in those days?
Well, they were recording saves and things like that, but it wasn't put into a database that you can access now. So
you're kidding.
It's kind of lost, sort of semi-lost.
Because often when you hear these records, it's like, oh, well, the most since 2006 when records
began. Yeah, 06 is a big one and 03-04 is a big one. They're two different...
But we're not talking about like 1806.
Yeah, you go back to 2003 and people were... You know, it was a different
What happened?
Time.
Did like a large black obelisk appear in front of...
They just got a better computer, like many of us did in the early 2000s.
If you went back, say, to, I don't know, what do you say, 97?
Yeah.
With your talk of field tilt and XXG.
Yeah.
They'd all...
Worship you as the Messiah.
No, they'd probably burn you at the stake.
Burn you
at the
stake, yeah.
Rightly so.
Oh, yeah, totally. You'd be tilted into a lake.
You would. Yeah. But I'm just stunned by the notion of all these people watching games with their, you know, their feet up at whatever the kind of appropriate place would be in the league or whatever. And nobody actually making any notes. I mean, that's really basic, the number of saves you make in a game.
Yeah, but it feels basic now. But then it was, you know, I can remember a time when even recording shots was seen as outlandishly pointless by traditionalists.
And the feet.
I can remember a time when the score wasn't even on the TV.
Yeah.
And you had to guess from the inflection of the commentator's
voice.
Well,
that was when commentators would repeatedly say, for those just coming in from work, the score currently is, you know.
Yeah.
So 2003-04, for example, so would no one go back and just watch all the games and then...
And that's not, a good question. That has been investigated and explored, but half the games from the 90s have gone. There's only...
What do you mean?
Disappeared. There's literally no tapes left of loads of games from the 90s.
Somebody record over them with, I don't know, Strictly?
blank, yeah.
No, EastEnders Omnibus.
So up to a few years ago, went back and did assists for every goal back to 92, which took a long time.
How did they do that without the video footage?
Well, the goals,
I presume they've got.
Well, no, it meant someone had to go through eBay and find a lot of old club end-of-season videos. And
You're
that
kidding.
Way. No.
This is
incredible. There's a big box at Opta HQ of... you know, Swindon Town 93, 94 VHS. And that was how it was done. And
so, you also had to go on eBay and get a VHS player.
Yeah, probably. Although I think the person did it probably still has a VHS player. So. But yeah, it's honestly that people don't realise that basically lots of the stuff, like it, whenever, if you ever see on Sky on Super Sunday, if it's Liverpool Man United and they show a big game from the 90s, the quality of the footage from those games is terrible.
Mm.
And yeah, a lot of it was just never kept. So
that's mad. Mm. Like they just were like, yeah, just throw that away after each season.
Clubs don't have an archive of their own games.
They would do now. That's the thing. Like, as time's gone on, you go to a club now and they've probably got an archive of like under 18 games for the last decade because it suddenly became sensible to keep all these things. But the 90s was the Wild West. It was like, we saw match of the day. Let's move on.
There's a great archive at Deepdale Preston Stadium, which is underneath the stadium pretty much.
Nice.
Which is amazing.
Literally
that
deep there.
Yes. They play above, like, you know, VHS players and that kind of thing.
Feel the history seeping up.
Yes.
Through that, that famous lost Jan Molby goal.
Mm.
Jan Molby scored this, like, incredible goal for Liverpool against Man United in the League Cup or something. And there was a strike.
Mm.
Some sort of TV strike. And so it wasn't filmed. And everyone who was there, well, ooh, the Liverpool fans at least, swore it was one of the greatest goals I'd ever seen. And then the footage resurfaced.
Yeah.
And it was like CCTV from the back of the soundstand. It was pretty good.
It was good.
It was pretty good. It was hard to stand up to like 30 years of anticipation, but it's, you know, decent.
But, you know, I think this is quite apt for this weekend because there's going to be a lot of people on Saturday going, oh, all these games that aren't on telly. But as Tom mentioned, this strike in the mid-80s, St and Greasy did a thing where I think they got Frank McAvenny, who was at that point, he'd come down from Scotland, he was a top scorer in the first division. But no one had seen him on telly because there were no games. They took him around London and were going up to people and going, who's this? And people were like, I don't know. Imagine that now. Imagine going around like Erling Haaland last year and going, who's this? And people were like, don't know, some bloke. Time moves on.
It's another word, isn't it? The past.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, well, let's return to the shiny present when things have never been better. Certainly that's true of Brighton, who are in the early kickoff on Saturday. They're going to be at Aston Villa, both coming off midweek defeats in the League Cup. Villa beaten by Everton, Brighton by Chelsea. But in the Premier League, Brighton have kicked the season off with 5 wins out of 6. Woo! They're averaging 3 goals a game this season. They scored in 22 straight Premier League matches. Ooh, also, they've yet to keep a clean sheet this season, but still. What do you think? Villa have actually won their last 4 meetings with the Seagulls. But they feel like the kind of team that Brighton would like to play against. Is that right?
Villa have been kind of feast and famine in that they've had some quite impressive results and quite impressive performances, but also got thrashed 5-1 by Newcastle on the opening day.
Mm.
Were very comfortably beaten by Liverpool at Anfield. Knocked out the cup by Everton in midweek, albeit with a second string team. So kind of hard to know what you get. And Brighton, apart from that one defeat at West Ham, who can do that to possession teams, have looked, you know, pretty impressive.
They're like the knife edge teams, aren't they, these two? Like, they can be brilliant, and mostly they are, but it can also go badly wrong. So it's a good game, this.
Might be a brilliant game. They might both be brilliant, or it might go badly wrong for both of them.
Yeah, they might both lose.
At 3 o'clock, meanwhile, on Saturday, a couple of games still to tell you about. One of them is Man United against Crystal Palace. They've just beaten Crystal Palace at Old Trafford 3-0 in the Carabao Cup, with Sofyan Amrabat making his United debut at left back. Roy Hodgson, Palace manager, is unbeaten in his last 4 trips to Old Trafford. An interesting game, that one.
Don't think any manager's ever done 5.
Is that right? Mm,
in football history?
In Premier League. As well.
Since they started making a note of such
football
things.
History. Yeah. Well, you say that. I'm going to mention 2003-04 here. United's possession below 50% in a season for the first time since 2003-04.
Wow.
Okay. If you're a fan, like a Crystal Palace fan, do you like pick one of the games to go to, or do you go to both? There'll be people who go to
the League Cup and the
It's kind of like boring going to the same ground again. Surely
maybe you stay up in Manchester, just do the double.
Some people like doing the same thing like repeatedly. There's people who go to watch a band like at the same venue twice.
Oh yeah, have you done that, Tom?
No, I haven't. But people do. People do going to see a film. More than once, like in quick succession, which people do.
I have seen. I have been to the cinema to see the same film more than once.
Which one? Was it Titanic? A lot of people doubled up on Titanic.
I mean, obviously Titanic. But yeah, other ones as well, when I've just loved the film so much.
Mm.
Stay in your seat until it comes
or
around again.
Or go and sit with other people. And it, I mean, this is an entirely different thing, but I always thought that seeing films more than once would be boring. But one thing about parenthood is you watch films again and again and again. And you do actually learn to appreciate whole new things about films. A bit like with songs, you know, the more you hear a song, the more you love it or whatever. Anyway, moving on.
I actually struggle a bit with complicated films.
Right.
So it would serve me to watch the complicated ones more than once, just to understand them.
Yeah.
You know, if nothing else.
Dude, Where's My Car?
For example.
Bournemouth taking on Arsenal, Saturday, 3 o'clock. And there are many interesting aspects to this game, but one of the most touching is the fact that it'll be a reunion for Andoni Iraola and Mikel Arteta, the two managers. These two were not only hailing from the same area of the Basque region, but they were actually teammates for a Basque youth club. And I really don't know how this would be correctly pronounced, but Antiguoco, something like that. Okay, so they were teammates in this youth team. Do you know who else was in that team? In that team with them, posing in the team photo.
Was it Xavi Alonso by any chance?
Boom! It was Xavi Alonso. What a team that must have been. Can you imagine the carnage they must have inflicted on other youth teams in the area?
I think this is like a very Spanish thing, but Thiago used to play for a team called Valmunor in Vigo. And then Liverpool's newest sort of midfielder from last season, Omer, Stefan Bajcetic, also played in that team. Obviously not the same one because, you know, there's an age gap there, but it's just like, and then this team had like a real history of like, you know, these other players that had come through there. It just feels like very fitting. Like they must keep the VHS tapes, for example, you know, to remember all this stuff.
Xavi Alonso, obviously a player. Mikel Arteta apparently was the star of the team. And Tom Iraola as a player?
Nearly scored an absolute worldie for Athletic Bilbao against Manchester United in the Europa League under Marcelo Bielsa. Playing at fullback, I think.
Really?
For Phil Bilbao at Old Trafford and just sort of cuts in. Would you like to see it? Obviously, this is great for our listeners.
No, we
don't want to see it.
No. I will. Okay, we're going to see it. Okay, so basically he's...
Oh, no, this isn't it. It's the wrong video.
All right. Well, that's a shame. Well, we'll look that one up. But listener, you're a busy listener and you've got things to do, probably. We will sign off then, of course. Sunday afternoon, a little bit earlier than usual, so we can knock off for the golf. We'll be in recording our reaction to all the events of this weekend in the Premier League and anything else that's interesting too. For now, it's many, many thanks to Kiva, to Tom, to Duncan, to Rachel and producer Charlie, and you listener. Have a great weekend. We'll see you soon.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Discover bonus video content by searching for The Totally Football Show on YouTube and see the very latest subscription offers at theathletic.com/totally.
The Athletic.